Hello, the internet, and welcome to this special Valentine's Day bonus episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and if you masturbate to history textbook illustrations, you are in the right place, assuming you're in jail and listening to this podcast. We're dropping this episode on Valentine's Day 2017 because the subject of Saturday's live show, this is a live one, was the history of love, sex, and romance, and really went off the rails. We're going to be talking to Dr. Christopher Ryan about his controversial book, Sex at Dawn, which suggests that the standard narrative we've always heard that humans were mainly monogamous creatures born to pair off into nuclear families is full of shit. What he thinks is that humans were built to have sex with lots of different partners. The standard narrative says that women were always traded like property and treated like property the way they are in the Bible. And Dr. Ryan's belief is that prior to the advent of agriculture and civilization, humans paired off into tribes rather than nuclear families and just all fucked each other. So essentially, our natural state is the orgy rather than the nuclear family. Now, I've come to associate pro-orgy, anti-nuclear family beliefs with old guys with ponytails who are like a little too comfortable sitting Indian style with no clothes on. I'm picturing that HBO series Real Sex that a few of you might remember. It was always on HBO when I was like 12, when that was the best that I could get, and which had the effect of making sex seem pretty gross to me for like 15 seconds before I went back to being miserably horny for the next 5 years of my life. Anyways, Dr. Ryan is none of those things, completely unponytailed, fully clothed with a PhD, which is what's on his business card, in fact. He's also controversial. Most sociologists paint a picture of prehistory where life was violent, short, miserable, and solitary, I think are the other just stock adjectives for describing how bad life used to be. And I'd always just sort of assumed that the same was true about the sex being had back then. Just one-on-one mishposish where the woman was lucky if the guy left her conscious, and the guy was lucky if a bear didn't eat him while he was distracted. My vision of prehistoric sex is stupidly simple and cartoonish, but Ryan points out that that's not how, first of all, still existing hunter-gatherers live and have sex for the most part, and that based on our body design and the behaviors of the hunter-gatherer tribes that we have access to, he thinks prehistoric men probably lived lives of leisure and near constant boning. By the way, when I say prehistoric man, don't picture like caveman. Prehistory wasn't that long ago. It was just basically before the Bible and ancient Greece. People had technology and wheels and knew how to use fire. And as we've discussed on this podcast before, the human species has been around for 200,000 years. So prehistory is 196,000 of those 200,000 years, as I think Dr. Ryan even brings up in this episode. But he paints a picture of a tribal society where both men and women were openly promiscuous. The new thing that we, with our advanced society, bring to the table isn't all our crazy sexual positions and advanced ideals. It's just the expectation that people will only have sex with one partner for over half their lives, and the addition of shame and guilt over failing to do that. He describes a hunter-gatherer status quo where, because nobody knew which person's baby it was, the many men who had had sex with the mother would share the responsibility of taking care of the child. Another interesting point his book makes that we didn't really get to in our conversation is that the shape and function of our body and sexual organs indicates that we weren't built for monogamy. Two of the key design features are that men are only 20% bigger than women on average, and that our species in general has huge dongs relative to our body size. This is in line with primates like bonobos, where the females are promiscuous and competition to fertilize the egg happens between the sperm of multiple men inside the women. This is different from primates, where men compete with each other physically for the right to mate with all the women. That's how gorillas work. The strongest male gorilla gets to have just all the sex. And since the determination of who gets laid is happening in fights outside the body before the penis gets involved, gorillas have tiny little penises the size of your pinky finger. But their males are twice as big as their females, because the male that passes on his genes is always the strongest one in the group. But probably more importantly, we're also different from the only primate who is monogamous for life. I forget what they're called, but there is a type of primate that I think lives in Asia, he said, and only has sex with one partner their whole life, but their male and females are basically the same size because there's no competition, so men don't have to have bigger bodies or penises. But according to Dr. Ryan, being 20% bigger and having big, what he describes as plunger-shaped dongs, are particularly useful, like seemingly designed for sperm competition, which means a woman will have sex with many males and may the best sperm win. Another less outwardly obvious reason he thinks we're built for multiple sexual partners is that women's reproductive organs and tracts are built like an obstacle course for sperm. Which, why would that be the case if the decision of who to procreate with was predetermined outside of the body in fights for dominance or in some transactional agreement of monogamy like human marriage or Asian primate marriage? I don't know how they pair off, but it only makes sense to require sperm to win a physical challenge only if you're trying to pick a winning lottery ticket out of many. Like if the who decision is being made outside of the body, having an obstacle course in there only gets in the way. Anyways, it's a really great book that doesn't use terms like having an obstacle course in there to describe the female reproductive system like I just did. He's much more eloquent than I am, and we're about to have a conversation with him that totally undermines the institutions that Valentine's Day celebrates. So figured only comes around once a year, you know? Hope you enjoy it, that it doesn't ruin your marriage. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. What up? How's everybody doing?
Oh, boy. Good crowd. We don't usually try to wander out in the pitch black. That didn't go well.
Yeah. It's always a challenge.
But love is kind of like wandering in pitch black.
Teresa's just gonna be like really saving our asses dark. Already.
I hope a lot of people are here on dates and just ready to have a romantic conversation. But I should say, I'm Jack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And joining me on stage, we have the writer and star of many a Cracked video, the co-host of the Kurt Vonnegut podcast, and my occasional co-host on this podcast, Mr. Michael Swaim.
Hello, everyone. I just want to pause briefly to say that my own true love, Jennifer Moore, is here tonight. And, of course, she will say yes or no to my proposal based on your text and votes, so keep those votes coming. We need your votes.
Next to him is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Sex at Dawn. He also writes for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post, and hosts a podcast called
Tangentially Speaking
with Dr. Christopher Ryan. Next to me is a hilarious stand-up. She's also a writer and producer for Cracked. Please welcome Teresa Lee.
What up? Wait, I just want to say, when I was asked to do this podcast, the email that asked me said, Teresa, we heard you believe love is dead. Do you want to come talk about it? So that's my reputation at the office.
I didn't hear it. You say it in like almost every meeting. Video meetings that have nothing.
I'm just learning it now, and I'm devastated.
Okay, it's not dead. Nothing can die if it doesn't exist, so.
So you're a necrophiliac?
I think that's what we're getting. Yep.
Dead love or dead sex? What are we talking about?
Well, speaking of dead sex, we're going to be talking about concepts, the concepts of love, sex, and romance as they've evolved over the course of human history and prehistory. Yeah, so, I mean, there's nothing hotter than talking about people who are statistically dead from old age and, like, thinking about them fucking.
But they once had sex, yeah.
Right, yeah. Just make sure you remember that these are all people who were probably at least your grandparents' age. So, I mean, if your grandparents, you can just put them in your head if you'd like. But we do tend to edit the sex out of history. I think just for that reason, because it's kind of gross, like to picture
when you force necrophilia imagery into it, yeah, it's kind of gross.
For instance, the two history-based adjectives that we have for people who hate sex and are bad at it are Victorian and Puritanical, and those are both bullshit.
And Republican.
Yeah. And they are history.
A new contender enters the fray.
Victorians were repressed, but they like made lots of really nasty porn, and Queen Victoria was apparently liked sex a lot, and like in her memoirs wrote about how much she loved sex to the point that her kids were like, ugh, gross, stop it, Mom. No. But like she
with the Victorian porn, explain how.
What
yeah,
do you mean?
Etchings, drawings, what did they do?
Etchings and writings. I should have brought a quote.
Sure,
but,
slash fic.
Yeah. Essentially, but real gross stuff. Oh, and by the way, Victorians didn't cover the legs of their tables. Is that a thing that everybody else had heard?
I don't think anyone knows
of
what you're
tables?
Getting at.
Yeah, that, like they were so repressed that they would have to put covers on all tables because just seeing the ankle of the table would drive them to...
Oh, I thought that's why we did this with the tables stage.
You'd just be uncontrollably
Otherwise,
jacking
we'd be
it
having an orgy right now, yeah.
Right, it's so hot.
So you're saying that thing I didn't know about is not true?
Exactly.
Great,
nobody
check.
Heard that? No one? All right.
Was it Victorians that thought like calves were? Was that? Am I wrong?
Yeah, like so women weren't supposedly allowed to show their ankles or calves. That was the height of scandal.
I thought it was men though. The men would wear
capris.
Yes, and then show off their calves. It was like the bigger the calf, the bigger the you know.
Really?
What? Finish
Wait,
that sentence,
true?
Teresa.
The brain. I don't know.
Yeah. Puritans had lots of sex. It was illegal to have sex out of marriage, but. That's because it was like happening so much, I guess. Claiming that Puritans were against sex is like claiming high school kids never smoke pot behind the gymnasium or like right on their lockers because it says not to do that in the student handbook. And so it's like they just had tons of laws that were like, stop having sex in the town square, please. We've had enough of that. There are like eyewitness accounts of people fucking in churchyards, in ditches, hedges, in barns, bean patches, porches, and then like the servants would just have sex in the kitchen while other servants just like sat there and watched.
The Scarlet Letter is actually their porn.
Yeah, it's just like one super repressed guy wrote a story and everyone's like, ah, Puritans. And that actually brings me to your book a little bit because there's this other fact that we've covered that in the early days of Western Europeans coming over and settling in America, there was a huge problem with people, quote, going savage, defecting from their agricultural society, civilization, and like joining native tribes. And that's something that at least got edited out of the history as I learned it. I assumed that based on my history that like the natives just like bowed down before our like mastery of, I don't know why I'm identifying with, I'm Irish, I didn't come over, I wasn't an initial settler. So you have a saying in your book, remember the Yucatan, fuck the Alamo, I think is how you put it.
Forget the Alamo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but fuck it while you're forgetting
right.
it. Yeah, why not? Why not?
Can you describe kind of what you're talking about there?
With the Yucatan, the story with the Yucatan is that when the first Spaniards were sort of exploring the coast of the Yucatan, what we call the Yucatan now, they pulled an Indian. The Indians came out on their canoes, and they pulled one up on the deck of the boat, and the captain said, "What's, you know, cómo se llama esta tierra? What's the name of this land?" And the Indian looked at him and said, "Yucatan." And they said, "Okay, great. It's called, it's Yucatan. We now declare this Spanish territory, blah, blah, blah." Then in the 70s, an American graduate student studying linguistics was doing her doctoral research on Mayan dialects, ancient Mayan dialects. And she figured out that Yucatan meant, "I don't understand you." Yeah. So every spring, American college students go to the "I don't understand you" peninsula. So, yeah, in the book, you know, we sort of use that as a way to say, remember, you know, remember the Yucatan, forget the Alamo, because the point is we think we understand things, but when you actually dig into the original source material, you find out you actually don't understand it. You know, for example, one of the points we make in the book is anthropologists will often say, or the sort of the scientific literature says, well, marriage is a human universal. Every society that's ever been studied practices marriage. So now we know marriage is a human universal. But when you actually go and look at the reports written by the anthropologists in the field, you see things like, well, you know, so-and-so moved her hammock next to his, so they're married. Right, there's no exchange of property, there's no expectation of sexual monogamy, there's no expectation of paternal care for children, there's no like in-law dinners on Sundays, there's none of that, and yet he says they're married, and then, oh, she moved her hammock back to her mother, near her mother's, well, I guess they're divorced. Well, what the hell does that mean? You know, we call it marriage, that's not marriage.
So you're saying I need to get a hammock?
Get a hammock. Everybody should have a hammock.
Movable hammock.
And I believe in the book you refer to that as Flintstonization, right?
Flintstonization, yeah.
Sort of the idea that we want to project, God, it's so human to anthropomorphize anything. Look at Pixar, look at Aesop's Fables. But certainly that seems to then have also infiltrated science, right? We want even people from the past to be like we are.
Yeah, we assume that the past, especially the distant past, was sort of like this, just a little cruder. So we assume there were nuclear families. We assume, you know, this sort of this central organizing principle of a lot of evolutionary psychology is that men have an exchange with women. There's this economic exchange at the heart of male-female human sexual evolution, which is that women trade fidelity for certain things from men. So a woman says, okay, I'll only fuck you in exchange for the meat that you bring back.
This guy knows what we're talking
protection.
About. Right? Yeah.
You. I'm talking to you. And so that's assumed to be at the heart of human sexual evolution, because the man wants to be sure that any babies are his. Otherwise, why would he provision those babies? Why would he invest in those babies? This assumes a nuclear family. This assumes that a guy can go out, shoot a deer, come home, and share it with his wife and his kids, like some sort of prehistoric suburbia.
Right.
That's not how hunter-gatherer people live at all. So that's politics or economics that has sort of infested the scientific narrative. And people buy it just because they look around at the world and they don't have the imagination or the data, in many cases, to actually re-envision it in a way that's more accurate and also radically different from the world that we live in.
There's also just a lot of history. If I have to accurately understand all of it, like, I think there's a natural process of boiling down the narrative into one that you can carry around in your head of what you right. think history is, and it's almost never accurate. Or we wouldn't have jobs, the three
right.
of us, yeah.
So you're saying the Flintstones wasn't accurate, historically?
The live-action film one was, yes.
Right, okay.
But the animated is a crock of shit.
You know, the Flintstones was, sorry to interrupt you, but
no.
The Flintstones was the first show to ever have a woman be pregnant and carry her pregnancy to term, have a baby. It's the first character to do that, and also the first characters to sleep, man and a wife, to sleep together in the same bed.
That was hot. You're right.
Yeah.
I remember that now.
Wait, were a bunch of shows like showing people losing children?
Jack, are you making a note of this information?
Yeah, I know. He's going to fact check.
For listeners at home, Jack like scrambled for a pen.
Furiously.
He did. I got nervous there.
Wilma, pregnant. What are you drawing? He has some sort of drawing over there.
So a couple weeks ago, we had an episode where we talked about how
even though things seem really shitty right now, things are so much better than they were in history because we used to only live to age 35 and...
Bullshit!
Right. This is why I'm glad, like, I'm not an academic, because if I had had that episode and then, like, read your book, it would have just, like, ruined my fucking day. But now I just get to have you on our show and ruin your fucking day. No, I'm just joking. No, I got to have you on and ask you to explain why that's wrong.
Okay, so the thing about human lifespan is it's a statistical... Mark Twain, I think, said there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? And this is a case of the statistics. If you take all the infant mortality and include all those dead babies in your calculation, so you've got a bunch of babies who died young, and that's true. A lot of babies died young.
Happy love episode!
Yeah. Here comes the punchline. Well, we won't get in. Infanticide was an issue, but we can talk about that if you want to. Anyway, you include that in your calculation. The infanticide episode.
Flintstones was actually the first show to feature. I don't know if you know this. That's why they had to put Dino down.
Sorry, Pebbles. Sorry. So you get an average lifespan of 30 to 35 years of age. But no human was ever old at 30 or 35. Once people survive childhood, they typically lived into their 60s and 70s. And that still happens today in hunter-gatherer societies. People live into their 60s and 70s. Our species has evolved with a modal average lifespan, or I should say typical lifespan for people who survive of childhood, of 75 to 82, I think, is the... Gervin and Kaplan is the main paper you would look at for this. So the idea that we've doubled the human lifespan is simply false. It's bullshit. But as we were talking about earlier, ideas that are appealing and sort of make you feel better about the world you live in have a lot of power. So you get people like Steven Pinker saying, oh, we live in the most peaceful moment in human history. That's not true, but people love to hear that because... I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, patriotism is the irrational belief that you live in the best country on earth simply because you were born in it. And we have the same thing with presentism, what I call presentism. We want to believe that this is the best time to be alive simply because we're alive now. So it's really appealing. Americans want to believe they live in the best country that's ever existed. Well, so do the French, so do the Danes, so do the Dutch, you know?
The French just don't give a fuck. They're just like, eh, whatever.
They've got the cheese.
Right. So the way that this all ties into love and relationships is that part of your thesis is based on Jared Diamond's essay, the idea that agriculture and kind of settling down into societies was the biggest mistake humanity ever made. And why don't you say what your thesis is? Instead of
fuck
me.
If I know. All right. No, the thesis is that human life changed radically, and this gets back to, you know, this failure of imagination to understand how radically different human life was before agriculture. So just to give some context, human anatomically modern humans have existed for about 200,000 years. Okay, so we're talking about time frames that are very different. We're accustomed to thinking of the ancient Greeks or the Egyptians or the Romans as being long time ago. That's 2,000 or 3,000 years. I'm talking about 200,000 years, right? That people who look like us with the same brain architecture, same bodies, virtually unchanged, have been walking on the earth. If you put one right here in the audience, dress them up, you wouldn't notice any difference. So that's the time frame that we're looking at. Until about 10,000 years ago at the most, so 5%, we lived as hunter-gatherers. So that is the way our species has lived for almost our entire existence on the planet. And the way those people lived, there's a lot of universality. So if you're looking at the Inuits or the Amazon or Africa or the Papua New Guinea or Australia, the way they lived is very similar. You have egalitarianism. You have women's autonomy and authority equal to men's. You have a sharing of resources. And it's not because they were noble savages and they were better than us in some sense. It's because that's the most effective way for bands of people to survive. In Africa, they say the best place to store extra food is in your friend's stomach. right? There was no refrigeration. There was no way to save food. People didn't save food. What they did was they shared it, and then they went hunting again tomorrow. Now, we might go hunting. One day he's going to get something. One day I'm going to get something. If he's only keeping it for himself and I'm keeping mine for myself, what's going to happen to our social order? It's going to fall apart. But we need each other. So we share everything. It just makes more sense.
You wake up one night with me like, remember that food I stored in your stomach? I need that back.
That's right.
I'm taking it back.
I'd like to make a withdrawal from the account. Yeah. So what happened with agriculture is we shifted from this sharing-based economy that's based on plentitude, right? Hunter-gatherers believe that there's more than enough for everyone all the time, to agriculture, which is scarcity-based approach to life, where we assume there's never enough. We need to hoard it. We need to protect it. So societies become hierarchical. You get organization where you need to sow, you need to harvest, you need to protect the harvest. Someone needs to decide how we're going to distribute this food. If there's a plague, oh, what are we going to do? We have half as much as we need. Who's going to get some? Who isn't going to get some? We need standing armies to protect the land. You get population expanding very rapidly. So now we need armies to take more land. So you become expansionist. Economic growth becomes this sort of central organizing principle. And by the way, women move from being equal to men to being the property of men. If you read the Old Testament, you know, they say, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, which we've all heard, right? And we think that's commenting on respecting your neighbor's marriage. But if you read it in context, it says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his house, nor his slaves, nor his ox, nor his ass. Seriously. His wife is just some of his property. So it's a radical shift in the way we lived. And as Jared Diamond has said, it's the worst mistake in the history of the human race. And I think there's a very strong argument to be made that he's right.
Yeah, so I wonder what, if you could go into that, why then would you consider it a mistake? Because there's so many different metrics to look at quality of life, you know?
Sure. Like,
that's very interesting, what you just said about the change of the role of females in society. But having already discussed necrophilia on the podcast, I guess I can go here. I have to imagine, or is this bullshit, anthropologically speaking, that, like, for example, rape statistics against women were pretty lousy 200,000 years ago. Like, aren't there things that we do systemically as part of the social contract that are, like, inarguably, like, well, that if you were the victim of that, you would want that protection in place?
Well, certainly there are no reliable data on rape statistics 200,000 years
exactly,
ago.
Exactly, yeah. So just, it's weird to call it a mistake, industrialization, I guess, or the moving to like high population density mistake. There's so many negatives, but I can imagine so easily so many negatives of living in what must have been a brutal existence 200,000 years ago in some ways as well. Or am I completely misimagining, because of what I've been fed, what that life was like?
What you're describing is what I call the neo-Hobbesian view of pre-state people. So Hobbes famously said, and this is in 1651, Hobbes wrote in Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes, life before the state was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, right? It's a line we've all heard, which is amazing when you think about how long ago he wrote it. I mean, that is probably one of the most famous statements in the English language. It's wrong, 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 and wrong. Life was not solitary. It was not poor. It was not nasty. It was not brutish. It was not short. This is propaganda that is very useful for making us feel happy about the world we live in presently. It justifies authority structures.
Right,
sorry?
Are we supposed to feel happy?
What's
right
that?
Now? I think I'm doing it wrong.
Well, I think actually a lot of people are questioning it now, which is, there's a line we use in Sex at Dawn, which, by the way, was co-authored with my wife, Casilda Jetta, which is why I keep saying we. We use this line from Arthur Miller, where he says, an era can be considered over when its basic illusions have been exhausted. And I think we live in a moment, we live at the end of an era. The basic illusions of our age are exhausted.
I think maybe for men and women it's a little different. I think most women, we have been disillusioned for a long time. Maybe men are now realizing.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I think a lot of men are like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
White guys
you
are
guys,
like,
yeah. What have you guys been dealing with?
You guys don't like it when we just get all the good stuff? What?
Well,
no, good point. And also people of color are going like, you guys don't like living in a country where you don't feel welcome? Oh, welcome to our world, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to piggyback off of what Michael was saying earlier about the rape statistics, and in your book you talk about some of these tribes that have more progressive views of marriage, where back then we assume that everyone's like trying to go to monogamy, and then you talk about these tribes that have ceremonies where the wife will sleep with all the men in the family before their wedding night and things like this. And it's sort of described in a way that I feel like is supposed to make us feel, oh, they're so progressive about it. But when I heard it, it didn't feel like the woman had a choice still, and it still felt like, oh, these women are basically just gangbanged on their wedding night.
And that's in Canada, right? That's the Canadian ritual.
That's just,
it was shocking to me.
Well, I know, man, stay in America. I'm just curious about sort of when you're researching that, are we supposed to feel that that's a more progressive view, or that we've come further from that and we're at a better place? Because I don't know that I feel like we're in a better place necessarily, but I don't know if I want that either.
Well, you know, as a writer, I would never tell you what you're supposed to feel. I'm just telling you what I believe to be true, right, as a popular science book. How you choose to react to that is totally up to you. You know, some people think our book is advocating polyamory or swinging or orgies. It's not advocating anything other than having a more accurate sense of what kind of animal Homo sapiens is. You know, I've often said monogamy is like vegetarianism. It can be a great choice. It can be healthy. It can be ethical. It can make sense in so many different levels. There's nothing wrong with being a vegetarian. But just because you decide to be a vegetarian doesn't mean bacon stops smelling good, right? So you're still going to be an omnivore. You're never going to be an herbivore. So you can say, hey, I'm only going to have sex with this person the rest of my life. Good for you. Good for your partner, whatever. But if you're still attracted to other people, which you will be, and which your partner will be, don't consider that to be a failure of your relationship or a personal failing on your part. It's just, you're a Homo sapien. That's the way it works.
Can you describe what we evolved as, like, sexually speaking, like how the tribes, when evolution was like, all right, you're done, Homo sapiens, that's it, you're perfect. How are those people having sex?
Jack's asking you to explain how sex works.
Like, so,
doggy
a man
style.
And a woman, you talk about there being, like, women having sex with multiple men in a lot of hunter-gatherer tribes. Can you go into detail? Because I'm assuming
sure.
Not everybody here has...
Yeah, can you use the Flintstones as an
How much detail do you guys want? Well, I also want to... I think I didn't totally answer your question, Teresa, about women's experience. Now, of course, we don't know, because we're talking about a long time ago. But by looking at contemporary hunter-gatherer people, it's striking that women's autonomy is equal to men's. Almost always. There are a couple tribes where that's not the case. There are a couple tribes where women are considered the property of men, but it's very unusual. And those are tribes that have been traumatized by, you know, settlers and disease and a lot of stuff that's happened. So it's pretty safe to conclude that the typical hunter-gatherer status for women is equal to men. Now, if a woman's status is equal to a man's, and this is part of the point that I was making earlier about this economic assumption that we make that women need men to get the things that they need in life, right? In our world, until very recently, and still in large parts of the world, women can only get the things they need through a man. So a man has incredible leverage over her. He controls her sexuality completely, right? Women who are raped in large parts of the world are considered damaged property, and the man has the right to leave them immediately because she was raped, or they get stoned to death for the crime of having been raped. That's not a hunter-gatherer approach to this. A woman is autonomous. We talk about lots of societies in which women are believed to have a higher sex drive than men. And so the idea of women having multiple lovers is not seen as men taking advantage of women. In some cases, it's women taking advantage of men. Like we talk about, I think it's the Canela or the Culina, I forget, in the Amazon, where there's a ritual where the women will get together in the morning and they'll go around the village and they'll sing a song that essentially translates to, we want meat, you guys are lazy, we haven't had any meat in a long time. And they'll go around singing this while the guys are sleeping and the guys wake up. And a woman will go up and bang on the hammock post of a man. And that means, if you come back today with some meat, I'll sleep with you tonight. So it's a way to motivate guys to get up and go hunting. And she will never do this to a guy that she's normally sleeping with. So it's always about strange.
See, Teresa, it's all hammock-based.
It's all hammock-based.
It all comes back to the hammock.
That's the key to love.
I'm going to change my Tinder profile to I want meat.
Bring me
picture
meat.
You in a hammock. Yeah. I want meat.
And I actually wrote to the anthropologist who wrote this paper, and I said, does this whole I want meat thing, is this a double entendre in their language? And he's like, oh, yeah, dude. Yeah, definitely.
It still scans as a joke.
It's a, yeah. Yeah. It's, so if a guy's like definitely not attracted to that woman, he can say, hey, my stomach hurts. I'm not up for this. All right. So, but the other guys will all be like, okay. So they go hunting. But before these guys hunt monkeys primarily, which is dispersed, right? They don't hunt in a group. So they walk out of the village together, and then they agree they'll meet in a certain place before they go back into the village. So then they go out, they hunt. Some of the guys get a monkey, some don't. Then they come back and they meet up, and before they go into the village, they'll cut up the monkeys they get so that every guy has meat when he goes back into the village. So everybody's getting laid. Now, you also mentioned...
Not the monkeys. Their life was brutish and short.
Yeah. That's true. There's the thing called partible paternity, which is common in Amazon societies where, you know, again, this sort of economic thing I was talking about in the standard narrative assumes that everybody knows that one act of sexual intercourse can result in a baby. But in fact, many societies don't. Many societies think a woman gets pregnant because she stepped over the fire and smoke got in her coochie, or that she ate the wrong thing at the wrong phase of the moon. There are all these different ideas for what causes pregnancy because everybody's having sex and sometimes women get pregnant. So why would you assume that sex makes pregnancy, right? So anyway, there's this these societies in the Amazon who have an idea that sex causes pregnancy, but they think that a fetus happens when there's a certain amount of accumulated semen inside a woman, it becomes a fetus. So
you got to bank it.
Yeah, right. It adds up, and it becomes a baby. So a woman who wants to have a baby who's smart and funny and good-looking and a good hunter will fuck the good hunter and the funny guy and the good-looking guy and the smart guy so that she gets some of their essence in the baby.
Now you got a stew going.
Put it on a low simmer.
Right.
Yeah. And then when the baby's born, all of these men consider themselves fathers of the child. So it's called partible paternity. You know, so there are all these really interesting things where women are very empowered, or the Mosuo of China. There's a whole chapter about them in there, I think, where women have at least as many lovers as men do and are considered autonomous, equal beings. I don't know if that answered. I can't even remember your question, much less if I answered.
Well, no, it does because, Well, because I guess I was curious about sort of like how much choice they had. But it does seem like, I mean, I read the book and I know a lot of the different examples you use are very different. And so it does seem like they're smaller, so that it tends to be a little easier to control. But it does seem like a lot of them do have more autonomy. But it's hard to know in certain ceremonies like how much choice they had, like if she didn't want to engage in multiple partners, was she shunned, you know?
It's very hard to say because, you know, again, remember the Yucatan, right? Like, we think we're projecting ourselves into that situation and saying, I wouldn't want to do that. But if we, you know, like,
I didn't say I didn't want to do that.
But I see what you're saying. Their working model is so different that it's even hard to conceptualize
how
they are feeling about the situation.
Sure. Right? I mean, there are tribes of North American Indians, particularly in the Northeast, the Iroquois people and Hurons, where being tortured to death was a great honor. And it was a wonderful thing if you were not killed in battle, but you were captured so that then you could die being tortured to death. Now, to us, that's absolutely incomprehensible, but it's also incomprehensible for us to, like, savor the flavor of a grub. Or, you know, there's a lot of... We open the book talking about food because we think we know what is normal food, but it's just normal to us. You know, eating sheep's brains is normal to the French, and eating witchetty grubs is normal to people in Australia. So that if someone in that society is like, okay, I'm going to have sex with these five guys, maybe you're thinking of the Canelo where women go off on hunting parties. Like one woman will go with four or five men and she'll cook and have sex with all these men, and she considers it an honor to participate in the hunt. So if she's invited to go, it's like, wow, I get to go. That's great.
She's like one of the guys.
She's one of the guys. She's like a dude, you know?
That's what that movie, Just One of the Guys, was like, right?
Can I ask, and as a responsible doctor, you probably won't answer me, but it seems then that it's almost, whether it's good or bad, and from the parts of the book I've read, obviously you refrain from saying, I mean, that's such a complex call, what is right, what is wrong, or good or bad. You're just sort of presenting facts that you've discovered. But it almost seems as if it's an inevitable outcome of that organization that we end up where we are now. Because what you're describing is a really effective team effort to make and protect as many babies as possible. And isn't that always going to end up with a dense population that has to start doing things like having buildings and roads? And I'm just saying, it seems like we're fucked. Like, there's no way to go back. There's no way to change.
To put the toothpaste back in the tube. I think the thing I had always heard is that men are primarily concerned with their paternity. So, like, if their wife has a child, they're dead set on making sure that that baby is theirs. And some of the hunter-gatherer tribes, you're saying, like, everybody is having sex with each other, and then the baby is just, like, belongs to the tribe, kind of. It belongs to many different men. Nobody, they don't have DNA testing, as far as I know. And so there's not that instinct of jealousy. Like, a lot of our culture has that built-in idea of jealousy as, like, part of the currency. And if you start from that atomic part where you don't care really who's the father, then I feel like it makes a little bit more sense to me. But I do think that we couldn't have this many people on Earth if we had just never invented agriculture, right? When we were hunter-gatherers, our population doubled every, 200 years or something?
I think it was thousands of years.
Oh, thousands
of years. It was very, very slow population growth until the advent of agriculture. But there are a bunch of different questions in there. There's the jealousy question. Then there's the is agriculture and civilization inevitable question. As far as jealousy goes, I don't want to misrepresent things. There is jealousy in hunter-gatherers, and men do sometimes fight over women. And in some societies, that's the most common trigger of violence. So there can be jealousy even in societies where resources are widely shared. I see jealousy as an expression of insecurity. So in that sense, it's innate. Just most mammals feel insecurity and are afraid of losing something that's important to them. But there are societies that downplay jealousy, like many of the ones we talk about in Sex at Dawn, and there are societies that accentuate jealousy and this sort of possessive understanding of relationships. She's my wife. That's my kid. That's my. And we get that indoctrination very early. And we're talking about Valentine's Day, you know, be mine, you know, like you're third grade, you're getting little be mine hearts. And then you know, mass culture, like, we talk about when a man loves a woman, right? He'll sleep out in the rain if she says that's how it has to be. He'll turn his back on his best friend, or, you know, every breath you take is a love song. Like, what? That's a stalker song. What are we talking about?
That's where I take all my cues from.
Can't
romantic
you see? You belong to me, you know? So there's this, our society encourages that sense. And also, because we live in a scarcity-based society, if you lose your lover, you might be alone for a long time, or maybe forever. Right? Because it's not like easily shared, like, oh, she's got a husband. So what? She's sleeping with him and me too. Like, there's not that easy access to sexuality, all of which encourages this very sort of possessive, freaked out, jealous view of things. Now, your question, which is really profound. that's sort of the question I'm looking at in this next book, Civilized to Death. You know, like, if civilization, as I argue, is not such a great boon to humanity, and we can look at different metrics that you wanted, you know, pick a metric, whether it's nutrition, free time, quality of community life, quality of sexual life, overall health, longevity, physical stature, pick it. It went down with
access
agriculture.
To calzones that are delivered hot to my door.
You got me there.
I want you to speak, please.
Yeah,
on that
but
point.
The inevitability of agriculture, right? Because agriculture did arise at different parts of the planet independently. So there is reason to believe that it was going to happen. And in each case, the climactic conditions, there was a sequence of climactic conditions just before. there was a period of unusually heavy rains. So there was a lot of fruit, a lot of animals, a lot of food. Human population grew, and then there was a sudden cessation of rains. And so suddenly you've got way more people than the environment can handle. Previously, you just have a lot of people die, you know, just like happens with rabbits cyclically or, you know, other mammals when the weather changes. In each of these cases, there was one in Asia, there was one in the Fertile Crescent was the first one, there was one in Mexico, and there was one in Peru, where it arose independently and was associated with different grains, actually. There's corn in Peru and rice in Asia and wheat and barley in the Fertile Crescent. In each of these cases, somebody figured out, like, okay, wait, there was all these seeds here, there was this fruit tree here, and now obviously it's dying because it's not getting water, but the stream's over there. If we just dig a trench, we could bring water here, and oh, look, right? So someone figured that out, and it seemed like a great idea. It was a great idea. It saved lots of people from dying. But what happened was there's a ratchet effect then, because then once you figure out how to do that, then the population starts growing. Once the population starts growing.
Well, it's a whole different feeling. It's almost as if now you no longer want to, you just accepted scarcity as a, well, life is hard. Now you realize we have the ability to combat scarcity and
right.
death, and now you'll accept no less. Like
seemingly.
The hardest thing to wrap my mind around is always like how little people from far enough ago would care if some of their kids died. They'd be like, oh, well, some of my kids died. Whereas now that's like, you dwell on that moment for the rest of your life now, you know, if one of your kids dies. It's just so, I can't imagine not feeling that way, but people didn't. They were just like, yeah, 2 out of 10 died.
Yeah, several of Darwin's kids died. You know, and it messed them up.
But he was like, case in point, motherfuckers.
You have an interesting quote from someone that civilization is based on blocked sexual energy.
Freud,
yeah. The idea that because civilization like put all these like unnatural sort of barriers in the path of people expressing their sexuality, that turned people's energies in other directions. Do you think that's why like so many rockets and blimps are all dick-shaped and like cigars and... Because like Newton
is your
Newton
dick blimp shaped, Jack?
Yeah, perfect oval.
Okay.
Yeah, like Newton.
Does it have a little basket at the bottom in the center?
Yeah,
with a little. Okay.
That's where the.
That's the only
that's where
reason,
the scrotum goes, right?
Only reason Cracked exists. We're all virgins, and we have to make a website to get our
right.
energy out.
Well, like Newton died a virgin, didn't he, Sir Isaac? You guys don't know about Newton's sex life? Come on, what do I?
I've heard that.
Yeah.
But so, I've also heard they put skirts on tables, so...
from some lunatic.
By the way, the thing about the Victorians is interesting because, you know, as in so many cases, we only hear about a certain segment of the population. In fact, there were more prostitutes per capita in London during the Victorian era than ever before or since. Somebody was fucking them, right? I mean, there was, sexuality was rampant, but it was not spoken about. It was not in, you know, the 5% of the population that was literate wasn't writing about it except for a few memoirs that were very juicy and anonymous. But, you know, the average people were having sex like crazy, as they generally do. What you find with sexual morality is that it applies to the sort of middle class, the sort of professional class. Everyone below that, they're doing whatever the hell they want, and the upper crust are doing whatever the hell they want. So it's just the sort of normal people who have to follow the rules.
Well, you also talked about how back in the day, like, masturbation for women was so looked down on that doctors would have to, they called it a disease, and they would just service the woman, but they had to do it in a way that was like medical. That was the only way they could get that energy out.
Yeah, they were provoking a nervous paroxysm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how vibrators were invented.
And cereal too, right? Cereal was created
to make women come. Yeah. Frosted Flakes, they're great.
You're talking about Kellogg, which
It was invented to.
Let's
suppress.
Come back to Kellogg after the vibrator thing.
So the you want me to do the vibrator?
Yeah,
thing?
Tell about the vibrator.
So
they had cranks.
Yeah, the
and
vibrator
stuff.
Thing
was
late 19th century, early 20th century. The number one reason for a woman in England and the U.S. where these records were being kept, the number one reason for her to go to a doctor was to be treated for hysteria. And hysteria was this very ancient. It was described by the Greeks. It was one of the first diseases to ever be described in medical literature. Hysteria was evident in the woman's sort of overall body pain, difficulty sleeping, moodiness. Basically, she wasn't getting any. And so she would go to the doctor, and the doctor would treat her by having her lie on a table, inserting two fingers into her vagina, and then with his other hand sort of rubbing her clitoris and doing this thing with his fingers. And there are all these like medical articles and journals describing the process and how to do this. Very serious and learned and blah, blah, blah. And then he would...
The same people, by the way, who would be like, the female orgasm is a myth.
It doesn't exist. Right, exactly. Women don't
now
like...
Let me treat this patient.
Women don't like sex, but they need these treatments. And it was perfect because nobody died and nobody got better. It's perfect, right? So they just keep coming to the office and these doctors were like,
yes.
God damn,
perfect
my elbow hurts.
System.
So happy somebody Valentine's was Day. Like, this is the time of Ford and, you know, the conveyor belts and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So somebody was like, there must be a way to mechanize this thing. And so they started inventing machines that could do this so the doctor could treat a dozen women at once. And so the first ones were like diesel powered, you know.
And you know, just like the coal miners now, there was some guy who was like, my grandfather treated paroxysm.
My hand.
My father treated paroxysm. Now they're bringing in this goddamn robot. Where are all the good vibratory jobs in this country? Thank you.
Bring back handcrafted orgasms.
Artisanal,
right? So, you know, you had these machines, and eventually they sort of, you know, made them smaller and, well, not too small, but smaller. And I think in the 20s, there were more vibrators than toasters in American homes. It was one of the five most sold electrical appliances ever. I mean, when electrical appliances began to be sold. And it was all like, you know, oh, my shoulder's a little tight, yeah. But yeah, that's the origin. Now, the cereal, the Kellogg thing, was that the war on masturbation, which, you know, you can't masturbate at home. You need to see a doctor to do this. And we don't call it masturbation. We don't even admit it's sex. It's treatment for a nervous disorder. But it was felt that children masturbating would rot their brains and it would cause psychosis and all these horrible things. So there was this frenzy. It was like the war on drugs, but it was the war on masturbation. All this demonization of it. And it was really pretty horrible. Kellogg wrote a treatise. It was a best-selling book about how to raise your children. And in the section on sexuality, if the boy masturbates, he advised that you sew his foreskin closed with wire. Son of a bitch. Exactly. And do not use any anesthesia. He specifically said without anesthesia because you want the kid to suffer. You want to tie him down and you want to sew his foreskin. And for girls, if she touches her pussy too much, you want to apply carbolic acid to her clitoris. Okay? This is like 1910. This is recent. It was 100 years ago.
Yeah, that guy's name is on your box of cereal.
Right.
Every morning. Just think about that. Yeah. Also, another thing I want you to think about was that while he was like waging this all-out war on masturbation, he was a klismaphile. That was something that I learned reading your book, which means that he would get a daily enema instead of like having any sexual release. That was his version of sexual release. He was just really into enemas.
Yeah.
He's just like the greatest creep in the world. Like he's just...
Yeah, he would
so
brag about
up.
How he had never had sex with his wife of 20-some years, but he got an enema from a good-looking young orderly every day, male orderly. So the cereal thing is that the idea was that spicy food excited the sexual response. So you wanted to have young boys particularly eat the blandest food possible, which is why they came up with cornflakes and graham crackers, because if you gave him any sort of spice at all, he'd pop a boner and want to go jerk off. So that's the origin of all these like bland cereal foods and graham crackers as well.
That's why there's so many Asian people, because we like spicy foods.
Checks out.
I think it's funny that it goes in the book a lot. We probably don't have that much time to go into it, but if you guys are interested, you should check out the book, because I really like all the stuff you talk about, how like society has tried to suppress the idea that women enjoy sex for so long. And you go into how like women generally are the more sexual gender. And it's just so interesting to me, because even now I think, even in porn, like it tends to be, you know, it's all about male pleasure. And that's really interesting to me. I don't know. I just thought that was interesting.
Like even the nature of the orgasm is like a clue as to this idea, because the male orgasm tends to come...
It's a myth.
Yeah.
It's a myth, yeah.
Tends to come first, whereas women take some revving up and then like can have multiple orgasms. So why were they built that way if they were supposed to only have one partner who disappointed them every single time they had sex?
I'm bisexual, and I like men because I like attention, and I like women because I like to come, so...
I also had a question about that, because you talked about earlier at the top of the show, and I had the same question, because I know, or I've heard that that's a myth before. And as a man who I feel like I have, well, I guess whatever you are feels normal. So I've always felt like my sex drive is normal, but I'm not just blowing smoke to my girlfriend, because she's here when I say I love having sex with my girlfriend, and I love my girlfriend, and I really do never have any marked attraction for anyone outside the relationship. Am I just deeply conditioned, or like, what's your theory there, Doc?
I just want to say, I also enjoy having sex with your girlfriend.
Yes, and... I've accepted your premise. Oh. Let's build upon it.
We're doing improv. UCB, here we are. How long have you been together?
Almost 5 years.
Get back to me almost five more.
Okay.
Look, the thing is, and we talk about this in the book too. All right, there's a book called The Erotic Mind by Jack Marin, where he says there's this very simple formula he lays out. He says, attraction plus an obstacle equals passion. Now, you think about that. Every love story, every great love story you've ever read follows that formula. There's attraction, there's an obstacle. What's the obstacle? Oh, our families don't want us to get together, Romeo and Juliet, right? We live on opposite parts of the world. We're, you know, we're gay and we can't admit it. Whatever it is, there's some obstacle and you can't do it. And so the attraction builds and builds and becomes more passionate, and that's a great love story. Now, what do? We get together, we move in together, and suddenly it's like, oh, you leave your toothbrush on the thing every time. And it's like, it takes away from the passion, because we've removed the obstacle. So there are couples. My parents have been married 57 years or something, and a long time, and they're happy. They are really happy. They really love each other. What I'm talking about is sexual attraction. I'm not talking about love. Those are two very different things. And sometimes they go together, and that's great when they go together. It's like wine and cheese. But sometimes wine is great without cheese, you know? Sometimes cheese is great without wine. When you remove the obstacle, when you move in together, when your life becomes very domestic, it's totally normal that your sexual passion for one another will fade. That's not an indictment of your relationship. I was on a TV show with two guys on this panel one time, and they sort of said the same thing to me after the show was over. And I was like, look, that's great. I'm not telling you you should be attracted to someone else, but do you watch porn? And they both said, yeah. I said, do you watch the same actress all the time? No. Well, then you're attracted to novelty. We're all attracted to novelty. That's part of being intelligent. You like Thai food, you like Indian food, you like Italian food. That's part of being an intelligent creature, is this attraction to novelty. So I'm not advocating anything. I'm not saying it's unnatural to like really be into Italian food all the time. Just don't be surprised if you might want to go to a Thai restaurant someday.
Oh, okay. I lost track of what Italian food was a metaphor for. There's sauce involved. I know that. I guess I just want to say, in case there's other weirdos out there who feel that way, like me, in a lot of these discussions, I think the assumption that kind of makes me feel weird is it seems to be coming from a place that like sexual passion and sexual attraction is one of the top four driving forces in most people's lives. And for me, it's like in the top 25. Like, I have so many ambitions and interests, and I'm such a loser. I'm just telling everyone what a loser I am. But, like, I'm not out there being, like, the most important thing in my life is how horny I am all the time. And I'm not saying anyone's saying that, but it's interesting that anthropology always seems to boil down to, like, who's fucking who. And there's so much more important shit to me.
I agree, actually. And that's one of the important points of the book, that evolutionary theory is all about whose genes are getting passed forward, right? So that's why the sex is at the center of it. But in fact, what we're arguing in the book is that our ancestors survived and flourished, our species flourished, because we cooperated so much. And it doesn't really matter if my best friend's kid runs into traffic, I'm going to jump in there and try to save that kid. I'm not thinking, well, that's not my kid. I don't give a shit, right? That's not actually the way we behave. And so, you know, I don't have any kids at all, so I'm a genetic anomaly, and I, you know, shouldn't exist according to evolutionary theory, right? But I think you're right that sex is not the center of evolutionary logic, or it shouldn't be. And for a lot of people, it's not a driving force. It becomes amplified because of its importance in genetic.
I don't know why, but I just need validation. I'm like, I'm not weird, right?
No.
Okay.
America is kind of weird, right? The way our values are, like
Michael is kind of weird, right?
As an American.
But you say in the book that, like, our mixture of emphasis on individualism, but, like, also emphasis on monogamy makes it so that we have more partners throughout the course of our life than any other Western nation?
Well, I don't know about that. What we do is we have this idea that we're serial monogamists, right? Or serial polygamists, depending how you want to look at it. We believe in multiple sexual relationships just sequentially. What that means then is that people who are, you know, in a relationship and for one reason or another they decide they want to be with someone else, instead of saying, okay, well, yeah, maybe we can be with other people, but we have this family, we have these kids, we, you know, we love each other, we've been together a long time, our families are intermeshed. Okay, you can have lovers, I can have lovers, which is more of a French thing or a Spanish thing. In most European countries, that's sort of the way it's looked at. But our family stays intact. We agree this is our number one priority. In America, it's like, no, you want to have another life. You have sex with someone else, this is over. We're done, right? And then it's like, call in the lawyers, you know, split it up. Kids, you know, going between households. It's a big fucking mess. Why? Because you want to fuck someone else? That's an American thing. We have a very sort of immature understanding of the importance of sex. And I think this gets back to your point. We overemphasize how important it is. You know, I'm saying it's actually less important. You can be married and have a fine family and not be sexually monogamous. Lots of people do that. It works for a lot of people. We make sex a really big deal, such a big deal that you're willing to destroy your family over it.
That's the way I took the quote in the book, was that we have more life partners. So, like, in other Western countries, they'll have more sexual partners, but they won't have five marriages or whatever. But in America, we'll, if someone cheats, we blow up the marriage and move on. So last question, and then I think we have like 5 minutes for questions from the audience if anybody wants to line up. Trying to imagine how we got to this version of things where, like, it's strictly monogamous and that's what we think is natural. Do we just think that people like Kellogg just at, like, some point in the past just sort of wrestled control away from the people who were getting laid and being happy? Or how do you imagine that,
like,
happened?
Was there a media campaign to be like, America links sex to passionate
not even
love
America,
in a monogamous way?
I guess I don't see how the sort of sexist culture follows from agriculture inevitably, you know? So, like, who decided women had to be property?
So the key is that when you know, hunter-gatherers have no private property, so there's no concern with inheritance. Once you have private property, you've got this herd of sheep that you've spent your lifetime, you know, growing. You've got this land that you paid for with your sweat or your father gave to you or whatever. Then it becomes really important, like, who's going to get this when I die? Well, I want my kids to have it.
Okay,
so how do I know they're my kids? The only way I can know they're my kids is that I control her behavior totally. So my ownership of her is a part of my ownership of everything else. Also, with the advent of agriculture, you also have domestication of animals. So for the first time, people are very clearly seeing, like, that black bull fucked that white cow, and now we got these black and white calves.
Right.
I get it. I see what happened there.
Right.
So it becomes very clear that one sex act can result in babies.
So science ruined everything. That's what I thought. I just wanted to double check.
I would say private property ruined everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, we actually have a lot of questions. So first up, tell us your name and
what
your sex life is like. No.
it's all right. So I'm a big fan of your book, Doctor. Thank you so much. It kind of connected a lot of the dots for me. Do you think that there is a way to kind of ratchet back some of our societal woes, if you will, based upon where we've gotten to at this point? And two is, I know a lot of polyamorous couples, and they don't seem to have a lot of long-term success. And I'm wondering if the people who do have lovers on the side, if they're just maybe better at hiding it than other people aren't. So,
ratcheting back societal, the mess we're in. Yeah, the book I'm working on now, Civilized to Death, which will be out this year, I hope, is focused on that question. And essentially the argument I make there is there's no way to go back to any sort of nature or hunter-gatherer existence, right? We're going to live in an artificial environment. There's no way of getting around that. So we're going to live in a zoo, right? So do we want to live in the Calcutta Zoo or the San Diego Zoo? We can, by understanding our species, by understanding where we came from, what the environment was like, what our social relations were like, what our diet was like, our exercise patterns, all this kind of stuff, the more we understand that, the better we're going to be able to design an artificial environment that works for us. And so if you look now at a lot of things, you know, the things I just mentioned, nutrition, exercise patterns, all these kind of sleep patterns, social patterns, what's the number one predictor of long-term health? Feeling that you're part of a community that cares for you, right? That's not an accident. That's more important than your nutrition, whether you smoke or not, how much exercise you get. Feeling that you're in a community that loves you and takes care of you and has your back. That's because we evolved in those in that kind of context. So by understanding where we come from, we're going to be much better able to design a place for us to be in the future. There's a beautiful line in The Four Quartets by T.S. Eliot where he says, "The end of all our explorations will be to return to where we began and know the place for the first time." So I think that's the value of it. As far as polyamorous couples having less longevity than other couples, you know, I hear from people all the time who say, yeah, I know these people, they're in an open relationship, and, you know, they broke up, it doesn't work, and, you know, okay, how many people do you know who are in relationships that last forever? You know, let's compare apples to apples here. Not polyamorous people to an ideal, but polyamorous people to people who aren't polyamorous, right? The one thing about polyamorous people is they say, you know, we do the same thing as everyone else, we just don't lie about it. So yeah, it can be difficult. It can be easier to just lie, have your affair on the side and lie. But as the polyamorous people would say, is that the kind of life you want? Do you want to live with a person you're lying to? Is that, you know, your best friend that you're lying to? So it's a personal decision how you want to deal with it. And again, I'm not advocating any particular approach to relationships other than don't be full of shit. You know?
Good question.
But I would say to them, do you really have the energy to be worried about the sexual pleasure of like 3-4 people? Wouldn't you rather just read a book or something? I don't. That's what I don't get. I'm not horny enough, I guess.
Hi.
My name is CJ. I own my own hammock. And I also read your book, loved it. I also use it to illustrate to my friends that at least your thoughts are just normal. It's like, it's not advocating for one way or another, monogamy, polygamy. It's, you know, you think like a person who's genetically built this way. But your book, Sex at Dawn, one of the things it hit on that I wanted to hear your opinion was just how genetically we are built to be more than monogamous. Just from like, I know you mentioned like penis length compared to apes and where the breasts are placed. And
yeah, we didn't get into any of that stuff. That's good stuff, yeah. I could talk for another hour about monkey balls, as I said, and human balls. But yeah, there are a lot of indications that our species practiced what we call multi-partner mating in the past. So it's not just, you know, a lot of people think we're talking about one man having lots of different female partners. We're talking about females having lots of different male partners as well. It's a mix. And yeah, there are many indications of this. The fact that our testicles are outside our body, for example, that if you look at gorillas, their testicles are inside their body. Gorillas have a harem-based system where it's one male and several females, and the alpha male drives out the other competing males. So the biggest, strongest male is favored genetically, which is why male gorillas are about twice the size of female gorillas, right? It's called body size dimorphism. When you look at other apes, we're about 20%. The males are about 20% larger than the females, which is the same as chimps and bonobos, which are the two closest related to us, both of which are promiscuous. We're more closely related to chimps and bonobos than an African elephant is to an Indian elephant, to give you a sense. We're extremely close, and in fact, many primatologists say we're basically three subspecies of chimpanzee. It's totally artificial to make Homo a separate realm from Pan, which are the chimps and the bonobos. The human penis is shaped in it with the flared head, which Dan Savage calls the plunger penis, and the repeated thrusting action typical of human intercourse is meant to create a vacuum in the female's reproductive tract that pulls pre-existing sperm away from her eggs. You know, the fact that women make more noise having sex than men do, female copulatory vocalization, it's called. There are graduate students with microphones in the jungle right now recording female primates getting fucked. It's like, you know, PhD thesis. So, you know, I could go on and on. I mean, you know, in the book we say that having external testicles is like having a spare fridge in the garage just for beer. It's a beer fridge because you're expecting a party to break out at any moment. You need to have cold beers ready. That's why our balls are outside the body. They keep the sperm cells cooler. They last longer. So you've got four or five good shots ready to roll, you know? Gorillas don't. Gorillas' penis is as big as my pinky finger, because all the evolutionary pressure's on the gorilla getting bigger and stronger, so there's no pressure on the genitalia because there are no other males having sex. When you have multiple males having sex, then you get more evolutionary pressure on the genitalia. That's when you get the external testicles, the bigger penis, the more elaborate, you know, intercourse behavior. So I've taken up way too much time, but that's a little taster of the
humans have, like,
argument.
The biggest penis of all the animals, right? like relative to body size, isn't that, like, that
what
was something
kind of inferiority complex are you trying to get around here?
Like, bigger than a bird, right? Like,
yeah, humans have the thickest, certainly, and tied for the longest with the bonobos of all the apes.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad you clarified the whole thing that it's women having a lot of male partners. I feel like there were, like, men's rights activists out there, like, listening to this being like, exactly, finally.
No, sorry, guys.
Nah, man. I think we have time for one more.
My name's Brad, and I haven't read your book, unfortunately, I guess.
But next question.
Yeah.
But I had a question, I guess it's a little, I'm not sure if it was covered, but what about fetishes? I'm just sort of wondering if there's
you
a sort of
for a friend
sort of a development, because I've heard, I don't know, pop science fact that, like, Egyptians were like furries or something. But how does something get from common vanilla sex to someone can't get off unless, like, they're wearing a Mickey Mouse costume and popping a balloon or something?
Good question. Fetishes, first of all, the first thing I would say about fetishes is they're almost always men. They're very rarely a woman who can't come if, you know, the guy's not
unless
wearing
latex.
Unless
you're in love, right? I have a love fetish.
You have a love fetish?
Yeah, I can't come unless someone's in love with me.
Oh.
Which will never happen.
You're sick. You're disgusting.
Speaking of only men, we should get... we only had three male questioners, and there were two women about to ask questions, so why don't you guys get
one
up?
More.
We'll make time for...
By the way, your point earlier that you come more easily with women, that's scientifically valid. I mean, that's sort of
sure,
common.
Explain it away with science.
Yeah. Women do tend to come more often with women. you know, we can talk about why after the show.
But it's
fetishes. Yeah. Okay, so what happens is there's a developmental stage with males that doesn't happen with females, where males and humans, it's between 5 and 10 years of age somewhere, where a boy will have an experience often that bonds in his mind eroticism and a particular seemingly random experience. Notice many fetishes involve women's legs and feet. The theory is that a lot of little boys are under the table and they see their friend, their mother's friend there or something, and they, you know, rubbing on the floor or whatever they're doing, and they get a feeling and they're looking at their mother's friend's legs and they get this like, oh, red shoes, you know? And then it's like hot wax, and it's sort of branded into the boy, and then that wax solidifies, and for the rest of his life he gets off on red shoes. And this is, very interestingly, it's not only humans. This happens with other mammals. We don't have time to get into it, but we talk about some research in sheep and goats and other animals that sort of replicate this effect. Whereas females have a more sort of malleable, changeable, plastic sexual response throughout their lifetimes, which is one of the reasons why women can be much more relaxed about bisexual stuff. Like, women can have sex with other women without ever considering themselves bisexual. Like, I'm not bisexual. I just, you know, had sex with her. It doesn't matter. Men, it's like, ah, wait a minute. Who am I? What's going on? It's all sort of tied into identity in some weird way. So that's why, you know, fetishes tend to be, first of all, male. And they also, interestingly, in hunter-gatherer societies that are very sex positive and relaxed about sexuality, you have very few fetishes. So they seem to be related to repression, sexual repression as well.
That is not surprising at all to me.
Right.
All right, let's get to our next question.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you about what you feel is the link between feminism and paternity, because as you were speaking, and I think Jack mentioned this, before the agricultural revolution, they didn't have science, so they didn't know how babies were being born. So I feel like there was more equalness, egalitarianism between men and women. After the agricultural revolution, we have societies like ours where men do not want as many children as they do in some of the less developed agriculture societies. I shouldn't say less developed, I should say more in the industrial era than we are. And I feel like that has a tremendous link to feminism. What are your thoughts on that, on a man going, okay, because I want multiple children, because there's high infant mortality, you know, you are my property, you're going to be my baby factory. What are your thoughts on that? And how do you see the global society kind of progressing so that there is more feminism?
That's exactly how I proposed to my wife, was you're going to be my baby factory. You're my property. And, yeah.
Women dig that.
Yeah. Just take charge, guys.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I think part of it is that agriculturalists see other animals as property that can be owned. And when you're raising sheep or cows or whatever, you're very conscious of the sexual behavior of those animals, right? So if there's a male who is sick or something, you'll cull him from the herd very early because you don't want those genes being passed in. So you become very fixated on sexual behavior of the animals you own. And women were seen as an animal owned by a man, and as I said earlier, still are in many societies. In hunter-gatherer societies, women had direct access to what they needed. Women knew how to... In fact, women gathered more of the calories, typically, than the men did. So hunting is a big thing because everyone loves meat. It smells great, barbecues and all that. But 60 to 70% typically of the calories that people were living on came from the women, came from the fruits, the nuts, the grubs, the rodents, the things they were catching in their, you know, little nets and stuff. The monkeys or the big game, that was an occasional bonus. So women were, you can't mess with women. They're providing most of the food. Also, there's no coercive power if you can't stop people from getting what they need. Women knew where the food was. They knew how to build a shelter. They knew how to get to the river. They knew how to do everything they needed to do. So you can't cut them off and say, no, you need me. Why do I need you? I know how to do everything. I know how to get my own food. So, and also the women take care of one another. So I would say one big thing is if you look at chimps and bonobos, who are, as I said, our two closest related primate relatives, extremely close and equally related to us. It's like if I had twin brothers, they're most closely related to each other, but after the other one, it's me. That's how our relationship is with them. And they're very different. chimps are male dominated, they're violent, there's rape, there's infanticide, there's warfare between groups, there's just a lot of nastiness. Bonobos are female dominated, and there's never been observed a case of rape, infanticide, or murder in any bonobo, in the wild or in captivity. Think about that. Think about all these primatologists. Your name will go down in history if you're the first one to see this happen. Everyone wants to see it happen. It doesn't happen because the females stick together. So they're smaller than the males, and the males get horny and crazy, but bonobos use sex to calm the males down. Franz De Waal, this very famous primatologist, said, chimps use violence to get sex, bonobos use sex to avoid violence. So when the women, the females are empowered and the females stick together, everybody's happier. It works, the society works better. Now we could get into all sorts of questions about comparing chimps and bonobos and why there are more chimps than there are bonobos, but that's for another time. The fact is, as this stuff applies to feminism, I would say the first thing is women stick together. We are a female exogamous species, which means that on reaching sexual maturity, most of the females leave the group they were born into and they go join another group. Most societies around the world, the woman goes and lives with her husband's family. That separates her from her support system and makes her vulnerable. Chimps and bonobos do the same thing. The difference is that the new female comes to the group of bonobos and the women will welcome her in and she becomes part of a strong coalition. So if a male attacks any female, all the females will attack that male and they'll mess him up. So female empowerment by sticking together. And the other thing is, like, I'm in favor of minimum guaranteed income. I mean, this is a big issue, but, you know, there's no reason we don't do this except for some outdated, antiquated bullshit about, you know, people have to work for a living. If you gave everyone in the world $1,000 a month for the rest of their lives, which we could afford to do easily, global population would plummet because a lot of those babies are being born because it's insurance for old age. If you knew you would have enough money to live the rest of your life without kids, then a lot of that pressure in having lots of kids would go away. Women would get more education, have more autonomy, and so on. Thanks for your question.
Great question. All right, so we've got 1 minute. So, yeah, can you ask?
I'm just curious, and this is probably a long discussion, but I'm curious, in these societies that we're talking about that are non-monogamous and egalitarian, about the prevalence and acceptance of same-sex relationships?
That's a very complicated question. It varies a lot depending on different societies. In many of the societies, it hasn't been observed. So the anthropologists report no homosexual behavior. Now, that could just be because it's hidden, but these are very sexually liberated societies where a lot of stuff's happening and nobody seems to care. So it may be that we don't really know the origins of gender identity. In, you know, some cases it's considered to be genetic, and some people argue that it has something to do with hormones during fetal development. You know, we don't know what's going on with that. So it could be that maybe people just aren't born with those sorts of gender identities in those societies. But then in many North American societies and some South Pacific societies, you do see what we consider to be same-sex couples, but they identify with the other sex. So it's someone in a male body who says, no, I'm a girl, and the society says, okay, you're a girl. They're not that fixated on the body. And then it's further complicated by the fact that, you know, this is like this Yucatan thing where we think we know what we're talking about, but when you start digging in, it becomes really confusing. Like homosexuality, what do we mean really, right? So for example, in Papua New Guinea, there's a tribe that believes that semen contains the essence of masculinity. So the teenage boys who want to be the biggest, baddest warriors will suck as much dick as they possibly can to ingest all that masculine juice. And now I told Dan Savage about this and he was like, what tribe is this? And the GPS, so they don't consider that to be, that's just normal male behavior for them. Yeah, that he wants to be a warrior. That's why he's doing that. So what do we mean? You know, is that homosexual behavior? It looks that way to us, but to them it isn't. So It's a very slippery kind of question, but very interesting. And hopefully with more enlightened anthropologists in the field now who are more, because maybe they've seen it and they just don't want to report it because they're uptight about it, right? You know, so that's a big thing. Like when you had all men in primatology, for example, they said no other female primate had orgasm except human. And then when you had women get into primatology in the 70s, they're like, she's coming. Of course she's coming. Look at her. You know. So it's very sort of distorted by who's reporting on things.
Yeah, we definitely need more women in the sciences, for sure. I think there's a reason that the sciences still tend to be like one of the most sexist things is you talk about like Orwell saying you control the past, you control the future. And I think, yeah, the sciences just need more diversity. Anyways, that's it for us, you guys. Give it up for Teresa Lee, Dr. Christopher Ryan, and Michael Swaim. Happy Valentine's Day. All right, that was our Valentine's Day bonus episode. You couldn't see this, obviously, but when the lights came up at the end of the show, there was just a giant pile of thrusting bodies in the aisles just going to town on each other. It's a powerful book. Thanks to Dr. Ryan and the hilarious Teresa Lee and Michael Swaim for joining us. On to some quick footnotes. We'll link off to Dr. Ryan and Dr. Jetha's book. His wife is Casilda Jetha, I believe, as well as Dr. Ryan's podcast, Tangentially Speaking. And we'll link off to a scholarly article by Michael Gervin and Hilliard Kaplan called Longevity Among Hunter-Gatherers that sort of contradicts the idea that I mentioned a few episodes ago that people used to live really short lives, points out all the reasons we were wrong about that. We'll link off to Dr. Jared Diamond's classic article, The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race, about the decision to build civilization, essentially. Dr. Jared Diamond, who, for whatever reason, I always pictured as like a young man in his 40s, I think because his name's Jared, and I've never heard of an old guy named Jared. He's 79. Holy shit. Who knew? Probably everyone except me. And then we'll link off to a bunch of cracked articles. We'll link off to gender stereotypes that used to be the exact opposite, horrifying facts that get left out of history, X-rated traditions that prove history was horny as fuck, the most cynical exploitations of romantic love in history, factors that secretly influence who you have sex with, and, of course, who can forget insignificant things that determine who you have sex with also. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. Thanks to Chris Souza, who stepped in for engineer Brett to engineer the recording at UCB Sunset. You can follow me at Jack_OBRIEN, and that's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.